Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.
It is time, indeed, for Movies and Booze. Michelle Lawler, Brian Lloyd and Dee Reedy are two-thirds with us at the moment. Dee is stuck in a taxi, but should be here any second. If that taxi has got News Talk playing, get a move on, will you, mister? Anyway, good afternoon to the two of you who are still here. I'm Adam Walsh here from Ballyvaughan. I was the producer on the Guinness advert and it was in fact recorded in Romania. I think Adam Walsh and Ballyvaughan, you're lying. I think you're just up to no good. I think it was actually an identifiably made around Ireland. So, Brian, are you going to tell me that Moana 2 was not great?
I'm going to tell you that it was okay.
Oh, no.
That it was absolutely very fine. I mean, like, okay, right, so the whole thing of it is, very, very briefly, it was essentially a kind of a last-minute jobby. Originally, Disney had planned for this to be a series for Disney Plus, and then Bob Iger, the CEO of Disney, decided, actually, you know what, we're not doing that anymore, turn it into a film. So the lads basically had to cobble together everything and kind of fashion it into a film. And when you watch it, you are very aware of the fact that this was previously a TV show, because it's a little bit more janky, the songs aren't as good, and even just the way the story is kind of set up, it feels very much like it would work for episodic television, but not necessarily for film.
Yeah. Why didn't they make a Moana 2 movie?
Why didn't they make a movie?
Yeah,
The whole thing was kicked off during the pandemic, and everyone thought that cinemas were basically on their last legs and that they wouldn't survive the pandemic.
Oh.
That turned out not to be the case, and Bob Iger correctly felt that what was happening with a lot of studios was that they were basically making these films and then they were waiting like 4 weeks and then they were getting sent to streaming services, and that was effectively training audiences to wait until they were in streaming services. Not unlike what you were saying earlier about Conclave, where I was like, oh, it's really, really good, and Michelle here was like, yeah, just wait until it gets onto the streaming service, and I'm like, don't do that.
And fall asleep in the cinema.
Yeah, okay, but you fall asleep at home.
That's what cinemas are for. Serena Bellissimo, who you'll know, she would professionally review. She was notorious for falling asleep when she was pregnant. She'd fall asleep all the time.
I remember. I saw her do it full on, conked out at the end of the row in Lighthouse Screen 2. She would literally be slumped over, not unlike a old Renaissance painting, like the arm hanging off the chair. And I'd be like, Serena, and then you hear her go, and she's like, oh yeah, okay, Grant, and then the woman is a professional and she was doing it pregnant, and that's better than most.
Oh no, absolutely. And I think she quite enjoyed it too.
Oh, she got a nice
bit of rest.
Yeah. Nice sleep.
Don't get any better sleep than a cinema sleep.
It's dark.
Yeah, it's dark and it's warm. That's the thing. They're always quite enclosed and warm. Like, yeah. I get it. Like, there's that element of like a cocoon kind of sensation when you're in there. So I get it.
The other movie, Conclave, that you already mentioned. But Michelle has a point in the sense that isn't this just all set in one or two rooms? There's no big landscapes you're looking at.
No, but like, that's not only the reason why you should see a film in a cinema, because one, you have the sense of like you're enclosed, that you are kind of trapped with these people, you're trapped in this environment. And that's really what Conclave is about. It's about a papal election. The College of Cardinals are sequestered in the Vatican, so you really kind of get that sense of a pressure cooker thriller where it's real minute to minute and like who's up to what and who. And that can work in a cinema environment because you are trapped in the room with them and you're kind of like, you have that more buy-in, I guess, for lack of a better word. Empathise more when your environment kind of matches what's on screen, I think.
Yeah. So, it's a wine and a port today, Michelle?
Yeah, we are doing Portugal, but not as you know it. So we have two wines from Douro. So if you've flown into Porto and you can take your trip up the Pinhão, which is absolutely fabulous. So we have a red wine from where you would normally get port, and then we have a really rare white tawny port.
Right.
Something really special. So I look forward to discussing it.
Port isn't like, because port used to be an old lady drink.
This
is the trendy section. It's not an old lady drink anymore.
No.
When did it stop becoming an old lady? When did it cease being an old lady? You give it to your granny once a year. It's from the same bottle.
I worked in bars for years. And when I was 16, you know, you'd open the bottle of Sandyman Port nearly on Christmas Eve for the person who might come in. And then it would stay on the shelf for another year. And it would take 4 years for it to go down. The same with Tio Pepe Sherry. And the amazing thing about sherry is that it goes off after 3 days. It's like wine.
Really?
Oh, does it?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
But I tell you, in the bar I worked in, it sat there for years. So but do you know what's the amazing thing about half the country? It's that they think sherry tastes gone off. That's not how it's supposed to taste.
Because it actually has gone up.
So people say sherry rotten, which they say quite a lot. It's like, oh no, you're drinking the one that was open 3 years ago, so it's dead. Imagine having milk open 3 years.
Okay, well, I am part of that cohort. We think that sherry's rotten. I'm probably for exactly that reason.
You're sure, let's
tell us then which one would you like to do first?
Well, I was going to do the red first.
Let's do the red first.
Okay, yeah. Because the port has a lot of residual sugar. And when you taste wines professionally or, you know, for the academic purpose we're doing today, you want to go lightest to heaviest, because if you go sugar first, you taste nothing afterwards. It kind of coats your palate.
Yeah.
So we'll have a little taste of the red. So this is from the Douro. And Douro is amazing for a couple of reasons. The value is amazing. I think within Europe, the best value wines you can get is in Portugal. But the confusing thing about it, and you can have a look, if you have a look at that bottle, the only thing it says is Douro. It doesn't say Cabernet or Shiraz or Tempranillo. And so they've kind of now got a handle on how do I market this? Because again, I worked in Oddbins and Clontarf for anyone who ever frequented it. And I was always surprised when someone bought a Portuguese wine. I'm like, you don't even know what you're buying, you know, because it doesn't say the grape on it. So Douro's flagship piece is that it's a blend of everything in that field.
Yeah.
So they try to identify by region, because a lot of Portugal, it's all the same grapes, maybe in different percentages up and down the whole country. But Douro is really hot. It's the oldest wine, legal winemaking region in the world. And the wine's beautiful. Do you like that?
Yeah, no, it's gorgeous.
It is absolutely good. It's called Quattro.
If it's the Douro Valley, am I incorrect there?
Yeah.
And doesn't it have like a weird set of climactic zones?
Yeah. It's amazing. And that's why it's so amazing. And they were only legally able to produce red wines as opposed to sherry, or as opposed to port, sorry, from 1979. So it's actually kind of a new thing to produce. If you think of Bordeaux, it's hundreds of years. It's still red wine. But they've loads of climatic zones. It's really, really steep. There's an amazing, if you look at a geographic map of soils, it's like someone's put a knife through it nearly, of where all the layers are, of just plates moving or something. It's amazing. And so this is a great example, if someone likes a Côte de Rhône or maybe even a Malbec, to shop for red wines from Douro.
Yeah.
Because they taste big, dark, brambly, spicy. This one, I think, is just a joy.
Yeah. And they don't even tell you. They're just saying Douro. They're not telling you what grapes are in it at all.
Yeah. And so the thing to kind of learn, if anyone's into ChatGPT, I love a good prompt on ChatGPT.
What?
Yes.
How dare you?
I love ChatGPT.
How dare you say that in front of me? My God. These people are trying to take my job.
They are not. They are not. If you put into ChatGPT, please compare the main wine regions of Portugal with a similar one from the rest of Europe, and you'll get a good idea. Okay, I like a Bordeaux, I might try this. I like a Muscadet, I might go for a Vino Verde. Because it's, you know, how do you understand what all those regions are? And we're kind of only getting around to now. You can see Douro's written there, big and bold, on the label.
You can't just Google that. You can't just...
You don't get it properly written.
You can't
written,
just Google that.
Instead
of you're relying on AI. You're relying on AI to make your own...
I love ChatGPT. Love a good prompt.
You're ashamed of yourself. Disgusted.
Okay, I've never known Brian to get exercised about a drink he never drinks.
It's AI. I'm gonna crap about the drinks.
Speaking of, drink tea ready. Was delayed by a taxi, but if he asked me, she's absolutely hanging. You're right.
I'm grand.
Are you stressed?
I'm very stressed. I actually abandoned the taxi idea, decided to take the car, and then got a puncture as well. So the car has been abandoned.
Yeah. Where's the car?
Stung.
Yeah, it's near enough to here, so I'll go sort that after.
Okay.
And I was listening to you guys in the car, and I was like, "Oh my god!" And then, like, literally, was like, "Oh, why is that wheel not turning?" On the plus side, that car isn't going anywhere anytime soon, so I might partake of the wine.
Do you know how to change a tire? In if you weren't rushing, would you be able to hop out?
I've done it before, so we'll find out in about an hour and a half, won't we, folks?
People are already texting in wondering where the car is. I don't know if it's because they want to steal it or help you with the
tire. That's really nice of them. It's probably one that my poor unfortunate boyfriend is going to come and help me with.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Because that's what they're for.
Yeah, I mean, and he's really good with stuff like that.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
To be fair, Dee, it's probably your best chance for parking today.
Yeah, true. Because like the tire is so banjaxed that it like I just had to leave it in a loadie bay.
Oh no.
You're going to get clamped.
No, it's 100% going to be clamped.
You'll go back.
Guys.
One of the inflated tyres will be clamped when you get there. Oh, no. No, let's stay. I think positive thoughts. Right. Which movie would you like to do first?
Moana 2.
Okay, can Moana 2 after this.
You were gone forever.
It was 3 days, but I missed you every...
What did you bring me?
Bring you?
You said you'd bring me a present.
Huh. Well, let me see.
Whoa. What's it do?
What's it...
There you go. That's Moana 2, which no doubt the little ones in your house are greatly looking forward to. Brian Lloyd is now going to make them cry.
It's all content, kids. It's all just soulless corporate content. This has just been screen tested, audience tested, up the yin yang. You are just being bought and sold by massive corporations. This is just capitalism run rampant, kids.
Yeah.
How much AI did they use?
Look where we are.
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't, I'm not joking. It would not surprise me if AI was used somewhere in the mixture of this. Because, look, okay, it's very cute. You heard it there. It's very, very cute and cuddly. It's very fun. There are some moments of it that are quite hilarious. Like, you know, Dwayne Johnson, I think, gives a very kind of self-aware performance as Maui. Like, he's this kind of big brawn. Mm. Loves the sound of his own voice kind of character, not a million miles away from the actual Dwayne Johnson and stuff like that. But you're watching it and it's like, okay, this is clearly just sugar on the brain for kids. Like, that's it. There's nothing else here. Like, and, you know, you can try wrap it up in a whole thing of, oh, no, it's about finding family and it's about the idea of, you know, finding your own family and, you know, you have to go out into the world and make your own mark and all this kind of stuff. But it's really just like a vehicle for... There are now, there's a new boat thing that they build that, sure enough, you'll be able to buy at Christmas. And then there'll be the little chicken and you can buy that at Christmas too.
I think it's already in Smith.
There you go. Yeah, thank you. There you go.
Wow. Okay. Yeah,
yeah, that's it.
So the action of this film is set 6 weeks or something after the first
one. It's set 6 weeks after the first one, but in actuality it was 8 years since the first Moana was released. So the voice cast is as much as the same. You have Nicole Scherzinger playing the mother. You have Tamira Morrison, people would know from Star Wars, from Once Warriors, great New Zealand actor. He plays the father. Dwayne Johnson is in there as well. And yeah, I mean, it's pretty much just the first one kind of rehashed. Moana has to go out. She's now the wayfinder of her tribe, which means she basically is able to plot the maps that will bring them to different islands. But there's this one magical island that's been kind of trapped underneath the sea, and she needs to touch the land of this island to bring it up out of the sea. And when she does, it will reconnect the channels of the ocean, which will mean all the other islands in the vicinity will be able to travel and meet together and all the rest of it. So it's, yeah, I mean, like, it's fine. It has a bit of a family adventure. Like I say, there are some funny parts in it, but there's really nothing else. If you're six and above, forget about it.
Is it weird transitioning to live action for a sequel?
I don't know how that's going
to
work. I do not know how that's going
to
work.
For kids, that's confusing.
The Rock is going to wear some sort of rubber suit or something.
He's a big bodysuit on and all the rest of it.
He's now confirmed it as well.
Yeah.
And they were trying really, really hard to kind of keep that under wraps, so to speak. But apparently when they were filming some of the outdoor scenes, paparazzi managed to get some shots, and then there was huge speculation online as to whether he had actually beefed up that much or it was a bodysuit. But he's admitted, like, how much muscle there needs to be if The Rock is wearing a bodysuit, you know?
Yeah.
But like, if you remember, like, Maui, like, he literally has like entire animations on his pecs and stuff like that. Like, so I can see what, I don't know, like, this whole thing of live action stuff, like, I mean, again, not to be really, really cynical about it, but it's literally just rehashing everything.
Yeah.
And in doing so, it's keeping the toys in circulation.
And the intellectual property.
And the intellectual property as well, yeah. So they'll just keep, like, reviving it again and again and again.
Yeah, but the live action is just a rehash of the first movie.
Yeah.
It's not bringing the story forward.
No. Okay. I thought you were saying there that it was a sequel to... Yeah, no.
This is a sequel. But the live action is just a real life thing.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
God, that's a bit disappointing.
Isn't it?
It is. Yeah. That's just the way Disney have gone. Like, Disney have really become risk averse, like, in the last, like, 5-6 years. Like, you see, like, Inside Out 2, you see The Incredibles and all the rest of it. I mean, it's really become this thing now that they won't take a punt on anything because the cost of animation is so much now that they have to... they have to make sure that they've got a sure bet if they're going to, you know, commit all the resources to it. Like,
they did it with
Bring back John Booth.
The Lion King. They made it into live action with animals, and Beyonce was one of them.
Yeah.
I know, and it's a bit like, oh, really?
Yeah.
And like, yeah, I watched and it like 25 times as a child.
But the original animations are so magic as well.
I know. The other one, it's a bit...
Yeah, it's very... Yeah, no, like, I mean, they're making a sequel with the director of
that one?
Of, yeah, no, for The Lion King, they're making a sequel, and it's going to be directed by the guy who did Moonlight and If Beale Street Could Talk. And, you know, this guy, like, he's a really, really well-known director. He won Oscars and all the rest of it. So, like, the fact that he's getting involved with it, you're thinking, okay, maybe there might be something here, but I don't know. It's a bit meh, to be honest.
Even good directors probably have a diminishing amount of good projects to choose from now.
Yeah.
And you got to pay the rent.
And that's,
that
yeah, no, yeah, 100%. Like, I would imagine this is fully a case of, like, I'm just taking the money here because I've got bills to pay like everybody else. It was like with Chloe Zhao when she made... when she made like Eternals for Marvel Studios, like, and she was coming off the back of this Oscar winning film with Frances McDormand, Nomadland, and you know, it was just a beautiful, really intelligent, really emotional film, and then she goes makes a Marvel film, like, so that will tell you that even directors are not above taking a few bob and kind of cranking one out, like.
Dee, I have a question for you.
Yes.
You know, you're supposed to say, what's that?
What's that?
It's an interrogative statement, but that's not important right now.
I walked into that.
You did, yeah.
Is that a Jim Abrams thing?
Yeah. I was going to follow it up with, surely Jim Abrams isn't dead, and you're supposed to say, don't call me Shirley, but he is. Oh, God.
Yeah, he is, yeah. He passed away. Well, his son confirmed that to The Hollywood Reporter on Tuesday that he had passed away at home in Santa Monica at the age of 80. So, yeah, he would probably be best known for Airplane, but it's obviously not his only film. He started out with two guys, Jerry and David Zucker, that he kind of worked with on a number of spoofs. And he was co-writer and co-director of Airplane and co-writer of Naked Gun in his collaboration with them. He's also worked on a couple of other ones like Big Business, which I actually rewatched recently. It's Lily Tomlin and Bette Midler playing twins that are switched at birth. One of my favourite films as a child. I'm pretty sure the Extravision in our locale kind of offered it to my parents at one point because I'd taken it out so many times.
Ruthless People as well.
Yeah, Ruthless People. Another one with Bette Midler.
Yep.
Which is probably a little bit more adult in its content than Big Business would be. But like, fantastic career, and what an unusual sense of humour that he sort of brought to the masses as well.
Yeah, and also he remade Leslie Nielsen's career.
Oh,
Completely did.
Like, because what Airplane, like, I mean, that was basically a shot-for-shot remake of this film called Zero Hour with two exclamation points. And, like, Leslie Nielsen at that point was a straight actor. Like, I mean, I would say the closest thing he'd done to something even kind of remotely comedic was this film called Forbidden Planet.
Which is a classic.
Yeah, no, it's a sci-fi classic, but it's a bit campy now when you look at it. Like, but he was playing it dead straight, like.
And they're looking at reprising the Naked Gun movies with Liam Neeson.
It would work because
he has that sort of straight
deadpan kind of thing.
But yeah, the Naked Gun movies came out of Airplane. The studio wanted a sequel to that, and the team didn't want to be involved. So they actually went off and made Police Squad, the TV show, which only ran for about six, which is very unusual for an American series. And that kind of became a sleeper hit. And then they made the Naked Gun movies out of that, which was a huge success. And I suppose gave O.J. Simpson his
O.J. Simpson was quite funny in it.
Funnily enough, I think O.J. Simpson was originally considered for the role in Terminator.
That's right.
But apparently the casting directors didn't believe he would be believable as a killer. So there you go.
That's interesting. Oh, picked a hell of a day to give up sniffing glue. You can go on for hours. Lloyd Bridges was fantastic. Yeah. Where can you watch all those movies now?
Paramount Plus, because they're Paramount films, so they're all on Paramount Plus. But my God, I mean, the Naked
Big Business is on Disney.
Is it? Yeah. Ruthless People is as well, actually. They were
Touchstone Pictures, I think.
That's correct.
Yeah, yeah. Those that were kind of, though, but like the Naked Guns one, an Airplane, and a Kentucky Fried Movie.
That's right.
We're all... had the same, like, joke. It was
top secret as well.
Yeah, it was like a joke every three jokes a minute kind of thing. And even if two of them were crap, it didn't matter because you were getting over the good one anyway.
There was a really good piece in The Guardian when the film turned 40, where they kind of said that sort of unrelenting joke. They actually throw so many jokes out that they don't even respond to them itself or take a break. Which is how they get away with it. So some jokes land with some people and some don't with others. But everybody's having a great time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, not to take away from it, but they really did, like, it was Mel Brooks and Blazing Saddles that kind of kicked that all off.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And, you know, Mel Brooks actually did a lot of uncredited writing on The Naked Gun as well. Like he came up with the thing of Enrico Palacci, the opera singer that Leslie Nielsen spoofed.
Yeah.
And Mel Brooks actually kind of directed some of that scene as well, where he falls over into the stand.
Yeah.
And because Mel Brooks was the king of parodies and the king of slapstick and physical comedy, and you can see the influence. Naked Gun, okay, take away the whole thing about O.J. Simpson. That film has not aged at all.
It's still really fantastic.
Good. It is still so funny. And Airplane as well. Even when they crack jokes about, the disco radio station when the airplane comes off. It's still funny. Even if you don't get the relevance of it.
There's one or two jokes which probably haven't dated that well.
When the little boy
goes to up to visit the captain, that's probably not so good, that one.
Ever been in a Turkish prison? Gladiator movies.
Right, okay, before we all get cancelled, let's move on. Desperate Housewives. It's going to be set in an earlier decade.
Yeah,
so is it the same? They're going to digitally de-age everyone?
No, I don't think so. It's a different set of characters. So basically, the creator, Mark Cherry, has been asked for, he said he's been asked about 70,000 times when they'll be doing a sequel to the series. And he's actually decided to explore a different era of Wisteria Lane, because he said that is the character that he most misses writing for, not the actual people character. Characters, so to speak. And he's looking at actually doing something set in 1966, but in the same little community, which is funny because he said also that that's actually a set on the Columbia Pictures lot.
It's still there.
It was before Desperate Housewives. It had been used for loads of things. So it had been used for The Burbs. Do you remember that Tom Hanks film?
Yeah.
It was used for Gremlins. And it's used in advertising a lot. So he said every time he sees it on screen, he recognises it straight away. He knows all the houses and the individual corners and trees, etc. And so it's that area that he wants to write for again.
He wants to remake Peyton Place.
Yes.
As a soap set in Sinclair Street like that.
That would work.
Yeah. Crikey.
The only thing is, I think you could take the character of Bree and transplant her into 1966 and she'd be as realistic.
Yeah. Someone says, back in the day when cinemas used physical lettering on their signs, some wise guy changed The Naked Gun to The Naked Nun at the Clada Palace in Galway. There were queues around the block. At 200 grand in the cash machine, let's see, did somebody pick up the phone? Congratulations to Aisling in Kildare and her family. 200 grand rich here. Kieran will have a new total on the hard shoulder coming up after the 4 o'clock news. So, Michelle, let's toast Aisling's good fortune.
Congratulations,
Aisling. Tell us about this.
So, we have a tawny port made from white grapes.
Okay, does tawny just refer to the colour or does it mean something
else?
Yeah,
so it's a funny one. We had this advertised on the website as a white tawny port and the importer called me and he's like, no, you can't say tawny because there are so many rules in the port region. There's loads of different type of ports, like we were saying, rubies and vintage and late vintage and tawny. So there's a couple of things about this particular port. Most ports, the vintage ones, the ruby ones, the ones that are, this colour is brown in colour. If you pick up a ruby port or a vintage port, it's red in colour. And the reason being is that how you make your red port or a vintage port or a ruby port is you make the wine, you make it fortified, and then you put it in the bottle and it spends its whole life in the bottle. So it's effectively like a standard bottle of wine how it's going to age. But with a tawny port, they do the exact opposite. So they get their grapes, they make their wine, and rather than bottle it, they'll put it in a vat about the size of the studio here, and they let it age 5 years, 10 years, 50, up to 40 years in a big oak barrel. And what that does is it changes the colour and the flavour. And this is all, now there is, it is a sweet wine. So when you taste it, yeah, it's dessert wine.
Absolutely.
So the reason why it's a tawny port is that it spends its whole life aging in oak rather than its whole life aging in a bottle. And so unlike your vintage port, when you get this, it's ready to drink. You know, put it in the fridge and open it at Christmas. Definitely tawny ports, you serve them chilled. But a vintage port, you could age it for 5 years, 10 years. I got a bottle of 1983 port at one point, which is long gone. I'm born in 1983. But it had aged, you know, and it was this big sedimenty kind of bottle of wine that was obviously fortified. But tawny port is the colour that it tastes like. So this is the colour of coffee and honey and caramel and prunes and raisins. And that's what it's going to taste like. And the biggest tip I can give you about, and especially ports and sherries, and you think sherry can be anything from really pale white to like black, you know, wines taste like the colour they are. So we have a red wine there, and that's kind of brambly and black in colour.
Yeah.
And that tastes like this is the biggest way to impress people at a dinner party. And that tastes like brambly black fruit. Whereas this one is the colour of you know, coffee, caramel, honey, raisins, prunes. That's what it tastes. Did you have a taste of it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You
know,
and it is sweet. Does it get, now this is 10 years old, so...
Yeah.
Does it get stronger as it gets older?
And stronger in alcohol or stronger in sugar?
In like ABV, really.
No, so once it's bottled, the alcohol is fixed. And how they make a port is actually when it gets to about 7% alcohol, there's loads of residual sugar left. What happens when you're making a wine is that you can get up to about 15% in alcohol before the yeasts get drunk and die.
Yeah.
It's the best way to describe that. That's why you don't see wines over 15. But sometimes there's only enough sugar to get to 12.5 or 13. That's why the sugar is lower, or the alcohol percentage is lower. But with port, when it gets to about 7%, they add in brandy. So there's residual sugar. So it's actually naturally sweet. And the brandy they add in brings it up to 20 degrees or 20% alcohol.
And that stops the ferment.
That stops the ferment because the yeasts are gone, sleepy. And so that's why you get a sweet wine. So it's natural sugars and extra added brandy to make it higher in alcohol.
And how much brandy would they put in?
I don't know. And there was a thing, I don't know.
But massive tank and loads of fellas pouring in bottles.
There was a rule where it used to have to be brandy from South Africa, whatever their trade deal was between Portugal and South Africa. I don't know if that still exists, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it's actually a cool drink. And what I would say about tawny port, because we're kind of coming into cheese port, you know, Christmassy season, it can last up to 30 days in the fridge. Because all the residual sugar in it, it's like salt, it's a preservative. So you don't have to drink it all at once, and serve this one chilled. And the rule about how do you know if you should serve it chilled or not is that if you hold your wine glass when there's wine in it at a 45 degrees angle, if you can read the time or the writing on your piece of paper, you can put it in the fridge. If it's heavier than that, the tannins are too strong, and they just mask everything, because the rule of putting wine in the fridge is the cheaper and nastier it is, the colder the fridge should be, so you don't taste it.
Yeah, yeah. And that applies for all white wines, or even for a red wine.
And even red wine, if you get like a Pinot Noir or a Valpolicella, or even a Beaujolais, it was Beaujolais Nouveau last week, and you actually pour a little bit in your glass, hover it over at 45 degrees, you'll be able to read the time through it. And so then when I was getting to, let's test this, Brian. You can.
No, you can.
Yeah, yeah. And so the reason why I was getting into the rules was that there's so many rules in Portugal and all across Europe. And the rule in Portugal is that you can call your wine a tawny port if it's made from red grapes. But this is made from white grapes, which is really unusual. The flavour profile of this is a little bit more floral, a bit more aromatic. But you can't call it tawny port because it's just basically not in the rule book.
That's why the supplier was...
He was like, you take the word tawny off. I'm like, I actually put it back in there because it explains what it is.
She's a rebel. She's a
port
rebel.
I'm warranted for your arrest.
I'm an ask for forgiveness, not permission type of human.
Yeah. Okay, no, it's absolutely lovely. Also, because we mentioned this during the ad break, the glasses are lovely, plus also very clever.
Yeah.
Now, these are Irish glasses.
So these are producer Kilkenny Design with Len and Courtney. They're wine glasses, and each rim has a different colour. So that if you're having a party and you know, okay, mine has the nice tint of green, D has pink and yellow over there. So they're super, and they're Irish. They're Irish produced, sold in Ireland, so it's always great to support.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Clever, and a lovely shape as well. Right, so let's move on to our second movie of the day. It is Conclave. Here's a clip.
You should be careful, Thomas. Your own ambition has not gone unnoticed. This might be seen as a tactic to blacken the name of a rival.
Well, that's a despicable accusation.
Is it? I wonder if you really are so very reluctant to have the chalice passed to you. I shall pretend this conversation never took place.
Ooh. That music is really good. It really winds good. Up the tension. Yeah.
The cast are all people, if you were to make a papal drama, you go, yeah.
Oh, 100%.
Before you even had a script, you just put all those people in it.
Totally. 100%. Yeah. Again, this is the thing I would say about this film is that it's very middlebrow. I love that about it. Because they really don't make films like this anymore, which is, you know, something that requires a little bit of understanding and a little bit of kind of, you have to be engaged with it, but at the same time, it's really, really entertaining. So the cast is Ralph Fiennes, John Lithgow, Stanley Tucci, Isabella Rossellini. Isabella Rossellini playing a nun as well. That's just, come on, perfect. What's going on in this is that essentially the Pope has died. A papal conclave has been convened in the Vatican. They're all sequestered, which means they're basically kept inside the Vatican until the decision is made who's going to be the new Pope. And it's really just a political thriller. It's them kind of dividing up. Okay, this group is with the liberals, this group is moderate, this group is the traditionalists, and then it's them kind of haranguing each other and kind of hustling each other in back steps and all the rest of it and trying to figure out who's up to what. And all while this is happening, there are bomb attacks happening around Rome, and they've not been told about it. But Ralph Fiennes' character, who's the executor, who's kind of leading the conclave, knows about it, and he's trying to keep it from everyone as much as possible, while also using his kind of assistant, played by Irish actor Brian F. O'Byrne, to investigate the kind of the main people that are kind of in the running for it. For example, one of them, there's a question about maybe possibly did he father a child or something like that. And then there's another one where it's there's a question of parsimony that he's paid off certain people. And then there's this other character who comes in who was made a cardinal in secret, and he's the cardinal of Afghanistan. And, you know, his cardinalship was made private and all the rest of it. And it's is he actually who he claims to be? So the whole time you're watching it, you're trying to figure out who's up to what, what's going on, all while they're going through the votes of trying to figure out who's going to be the next pope. It's brilliant. It's so, so well done. It's directed by Edward Berger, who previously did All Quiet on the Western Front, which was the German one, the one on Netflix. Brilliant. And this is written by Peter Strawn, who's kind of been known for kind of doing sort of, you know, political thrillers and kind of spy thrillers. He did the Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy with Gary Oldman, which I think was brilliant.
Super film.
Yeah. So he's known for having these really kind of dense, talky films while having a real kind of engaging, entertaining edge to it. So this is totally worth a watch.
Yeah. But because it's based on a Harris novel, it's essentially a spy movie, but just everyone's men wearing frocks.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, totally. And it's not even a spy thriller. It's a political thriller. They're literally all you don't have the votes to do this. We've got to think, logically about this. You would nearly think it is a straight up political thriller. It just happens to be set in the Catholic Church and in arguably one of the most undemocratic elections in the world. You know, it's only 30-20 people can vote in this
election. Was that all? I thought there was more than that.
No, it's only cardinals. It's only cardinals, and it's whoever can get to the Vatican in time. Part of the conclave. Wow. Yeah, that's the whole thing.
All right, so if this was a conclave, Dee wouldn't be able to vote.
No,
well, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't be able to. Yeah.
Sorry, that's a good point.
One
in space in the future. Yeah.
If I got there, I'd be set on fire. I'm just saying, as in it's the whole thing of but it's that thing of whoever gets there in time before they sequester everyone, there, that's the conclave.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go, yeah.
And is Stanley Tucci amazing in it?
He's so good in it.
Oh, what a man.
He's so good in it.
What a human.
Yeah, and he's really, what I love about this film is that they give everyone enough time, so it's not as if it's all about Ralph Fiennes' character. It's John Lithgow gets a go, Stanley Tucci gets a go, Isabella Rossellini has this brilliant scene where she has this really tense moment with Ralph Fiennes' character when it's concerning another nun. And again, it's just that film where it's really kind of shot in a way that it's you're seeing the white of their eyes. Like, you see all the lines of tension around their faces, like when they're trying to concentrate on something. So it's so, so well done.
Such an incredible cast. Brilliant. Amazing.
And again, the fact that, like, you know, it's experienced actors and they're not just chewing the scenery. They're actually kind of approaching this in a really kind of, like, understanding, a very kind of aware performances, you know, the kind of way, like, it's not just you know, chewing the scenery the way that Ralph Fiennes tends to do. Quite the opposite. It's really reserved, it's really kind of measured and focused. So brilliant.
Conclave sounds like the death of Stalin without the forced humor.
Dead the Stalin is fantastic. I will not hear a bad word against Dead the Stalin.
That's Armando Iannucci, isn't
Armando Iannucci, yeah. I mean, there are similarities in that, like, it's a kind of a secretive election and stuff, and there's an element of farce to it. There are funny moments in Conclave. Like, like the Italian Cardinal Tedeschi, like, he has this, like, little vape pen that's, like, bright red.
And he, like, with it's got a little cross on it.
Is it red to match his cardinal?
It's red to match, and his phone as well, like, and he takes and, like,
what
he takes
flair for fashion.
Oh,
that
my god,
has.
It's so like there's almost elements of camp in this as well. Like the way he takes a pull on his vape and then blows it out. Like there's elements of camp in this. Like it's so funny. Like
okay,
but it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
Fantastic. Bringing all those themes together, Angelina Jolie and her lawsuit against Brad Pitt over the winery. What's happened
so
there?
The latest on this is all part of their divorce, which has been going on for about 8 years now. And one of the reasons it is taking so long is because there's hugely contentious sort of battle back and forth between Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt around the winery that they had co-owned together. And she had kind of basically said that, look, she didn't want to get caught up in this big fight. She just wanted to sell and get on with the rest
of her
life.
Just some Russians.
Yes.
She sold or he sold?
She tried to sell it to some Russians.
And he got an injunction, I think, against her selling it. But now the court has found that, he has ruled that Pitt has to disclose documents that her lawyer has said will prove communications concerning abuse, lies to authorities and years of cover-up. So that includes emails, texts and other written communications, but, like, nothing between him and his legal team or therapists or anything like that, but actually stuff that he would have sent to her or sent to other people in their lives about the relationship and its breakdown. But only just this morning as well, a document has gone public online. Somebody shared a court document that has some really, really kind of dark details about what happened on that plane in 2000.
Oh, yeah. I wondered what it was
when the FBI got involved, and none of it, to be honest with you, paints Pitt in a good light at all.
Indeed. The wine itself is, do you know
it's
about the wine?
Absolutely divine.
Oh, is it?
I'm probably going to drink it on Christmas Day. I love rosé. Yeah, and the Brad Pitt stuff, they did a really good job in it because they hired one of the top 10 winemakers in all of France to make that wine. And where it's made, Chateau Miraval is the name of it. It historically was a place where big bands recorded.
There's a recording studio there.
Pink Floyd recorded there. The Cranberries recorded there.
And one of those studios where people would go and stay on site.
It had gone into disrepair and they had done it up in 2011 and then and made their first bottle in it. And 2012, their flagship rosé. Now it's 34 quid. Like it's a special one. And it's funny, you wouldn't know it. What I love about it is that there's no celebrity kind of when you look at it. But in 2012, that rosé was the first time a rosé was listed in the top 100 wines of the world.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But I'm a rosé. Like, you know, people always think rosé is for people who don't know anything about wine. I love rosé.
So what's it called specifically?
It's called Chateau Miraval.
Chateau Miraval, right.
So they do Studio by Chateau Miraval. And the label is amazing on it because it's a gold record.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, and that's the baby one. It's like mid-20s, so it's still in the lovely section. But it's amazing because I tasted it there recently and I was explaining it to my other half and I was like, the Miraval, it's nearly like Chablis for rosé drinkers.
Oh.
Because it's hard to explain it. Why is it so good? And it's like the texture, the focus, and it's kind of in the nerdy section.
And not as sweet then.
Oh, they're both bone dry.
Lovely.
And if you think about going back, okay, so my port tastes like port, my red wine tastes like Bramley red wine. That rosé is this beautiful pink tinged, you can tell I'm really in love with it.
Yeah.
Lots of wine. Anyway, but it tastes like the summer.
Tastes like the summer.
Ooh, that's a good line.
That's a good line.
That's a good line.
That's our lot for today. Thanks to Michelle and Brian and Dee.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.